We're right in the middle of a series where we are looking at God and we're looking at the different colors, the different shades, the variety of the characteristics and attributes that God has. And God is, as we learned a couple of weeks ago, God is that God of the Most High, the Lord of the Most High, who is able to bring victory in the midst of our troubles or in the midst of our enemies. And again, we can't manipulate God. We need to trust him since he is the God Most High. But then we learned last week that he is also the God who sees, as he saw Hagar. And he was watching her in the midst of her pain and in the midst of her brokenness. And today we got the privilege of looking at God, who is the everlasting God, the eternal God, the God who just keeps on going and going and going. And as Buzz Lightyear said, the great theologian, to infinity and beyond, right? And this is the God we worship and we serve and we pray to, and he is in control. And what I want to try to do today is paint a picture of who God is, especially when we feel like God has let us down, when we feel like we're going to learn about a well today, when we feel like our sole source of survival is taken away from us. How do we trust and depend upon this everlasting God? And in the midst of that picture, we're going to learn about a man named Abraham, and we've been studying not only the characteristics and the attributes of who God is, but we've also been learning about Abraham and his story and the story that he passes on and the legacy he left for us. And as we look at Abraham, we're going to realize that he has a small story, but it feels like a big story to him, but it's in the story of stories. And I feel, and I've always taught, that my story is a small story in the big story that God is working. And I'm on a journey, and maybe a small journey, but God's got a big journey, and God's going to get the glory. And so we're going to look at how do we leave a legacy. When I was in middle school, the school system tried to improve itself. And I went to a good school. I went to a private school. And they brought in all these electives. And so you could take German, or you could take electronics, or whatever. They brought in all these different electives. And the elective that I signed up for, because my other friend signed up for, was genealogy. And I thought I was just going to have some fun goofing off in genealogy. And I don't know if it was my luck or bad luck, but I found out that at the church, which was the same school I was going to, it was a Lutheran one there, that I had three generations or four generations back of ancestors who were buried in that church. And so my great-great-great-grandfather was buried in the cemetery. My great-great-grandfather was buried in that cemetery. My great-grandfather was buried in that cemetery. My grandfather is buried in that cemetery. And so we're studying genealogy, and the second thing I discovered was that Fort Wayne is the second largest place to study genealogy, right behind Salt Lake City. Our Mormon friends, they got the biggest genealogical collection in the world, but then the small town in Indiana, Fort Wayne, they have the second largest. And so I started studying, and I found out some very amazing things about my family and their roots. Daniel Gagline, who came over in the summer of 1838, set sail on a ship called the Zeilen. And he was a bodyguard for Napoleon. And he had been injured, I think, defending Napoleon or whatever. And he came over from a small city called Oppenheim on the Rhine, there in Germany, on the Rhine River. And he came over because he wanted, obviously, religious freedom, but the economic times were very difficult. And so he came over to the United States in 1838, and he brought his family and extended family and friends. And what he did was he established himself in a small town called Pomeroy, Ohio. And on Pomeroy, Ohio, it's right there on the river, and it probably reminded him of his old city back there in Germany. And one of the first things that these Gaglines did was they built a church, a Lutheran church. They built a Lutheran church. I think it's called St. John's Lutheran Church, still there today, because they wanted to leave some legacy behind. When they left Pomeroy and went to Fort Wayne, they built another church. It was actually even called the Gagline Church for a while. It was St. Peter's Church. So they used to have a saying, and I understand politics in church, because they used to say, don't make any joke about a gag line because the relatives are probably somewhere in this church, which, again, when you have three or four generations buried there, you know it's a pretty powerful church with a legacy. And then some of the family members left and they went to Durango, Colorado, beautiful place, and they built a church. And so my family, as I studied it, they were very concerned about leaving a legacy. And as they were concerned about leaving that legacy, they encountered problems. They encountered challenges. They encountered obstacles. And that's the way it is with the legacy of Abraham. If you remember, in Genesis 12, God called Abraham. And he called him out and he said, what did he say to him? He said, I'm going to give you this promise. I'm going to make you a great name. I'm going to give you a land. And I'm going to give you a seed or an offspring. And basically, Abraham said that my promise to you is I'm going to bless you. I'm going to bless your socks off, literally. I'm just going to bless you with my blessing. There was also in that promise, there was a principle. And the principle was fairly simple. It was, if people bless you, Abraham, and your descendants, guess what? I will bless them. But if people curse you, guess what? I'm going to curse them. And God also had a relationship with Abraham as such. If you're faithful to me, I'll be faithful to you. If you're unfaithful to me, guess what? I'm going to curse you as well. And so Abraham set out as we've learned about. And so he had this promise of blessing of seed and of the land. And when you get to Genesis 13 and 14, as we've learned, there's encounters, there's obstacles, there's threats to what God is doing and what God has promised. And so often, that's the story in my life, and I know it's in your life as well. God has promised us in John 10:10, he said, I've come that you might have life, and that you might have life to the fullest, or you might have life more abundantly. But constantly, as I live in this world, I constantly feel like, God, I'm losing the grip around that promise. And life doesn't seem like it's more abundant. It doesn't seem like it's being lived to the fullest. And as you go through Genesis, we get these encounters and these obstacles. And that's what we get in Genesis 21. An obstacle, actually, to the seed occurred in Genesis 20, and now we're going to have an obstacle or a threat to the land, which is going to set the stage for Genesis 22, which Pastor Carlton will look at next Sunday. So let's open up our Bibles here and turn to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1, verse 22. And as I read this, I want you to see a framework. And God is painting a beautiful picture in the life of Abraham, and it's in our life, and it's in his legacy as well. God is painting a beautiful picture of this everlasting God who endures forever and ever and keeps on going. And he's painting this picture of what he wants to do in our lives when we feel threatened or we face conflict. Genesis 21, verse 22 says this. At that time, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of the forces, said to Abraham, you got to underline this if you got your Bibles or if you got one of our Bibles, underline it. God is with you in everything you do. God is with you in everything you do. In fact, that's so important. Why don't we just say that right now? God is with you in everything you do. One more time. God is with you in everything you do. Hopefully you believe that. Notice here in verse 23, it says, now swear to me, here before God, that you will not deal falsely with me or my children or my descendants. Show to me and the country where you are living as an alien the same kindness I have shown to you. So Abimelech saying, hey, I see God's at work in your life. Show me kindness. Abraham said, I swear it. Then verse 25 says, Abraham complained to Abimelech about a well of water that Abimelech's servants had seized or had stolen or taken. But Abimelech said, I don't know who has done this. You did not tell me, and I heard about it only today. Conflict in the camp. So Abraham brought sheep and cattle and gave them to Abimelech, and the two made a treaty. Abraham set apart 7 ewe lambs from the flock, and Abimelech asked Abraham, what is the meaning of these 7 ewe lambs you have set apart by themselves? Accept these seven lambs from my hand as a witness that I dug this well. So that place was called Beersheba because of the two men who swore an oath there. After the treaty had been made at Beersheba, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of the forces, returned to the land of the Philistines. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there he called upon the name of the Lord, the eternal God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines for a long time. Catch the frame around this picture. It's in verse 22, which we quoted, that God is with you in everything you do, Abraham. And then in verse 33 and 34, there is an everlasting God who is in the relationship with Abraham, wanting to bless him, pour out grace, pour out mercy, pour out love, pour out kindness. And this is the frame around this picture. And the fact that God is an everlasting God, an eternal God, a God who is perpetual, a God who never ends. If you look this way, there's God. If you look this way, there's God. You look this way, there's God. You look this way, there's God. God is constant. He never changes. His word says he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And this is the frame upon which this picture is held. Now, this is important because this is the main idea of this passage. This everlasting God is able to work even when there is conflict, even when there is danger, even when there is turmoil, even when our very survival, the well, is being taken from us. God is at work. Now, it's interesting to see how God is at work. Just let your eyes jump over to verse 1 of chapter 21. It says, "Now the Lord was gracious to Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised." So again, hold on to that frame. Never let that frame go away. God is faithful to his promises. This eternal, everlasting God is faithful to his promises, and he is at work. So he's fulfilling the promise for the seed with the birth of Isaac. He's taken away of all the conflict and danger to that seed with Hagar and Ishmael mocking the birth of Isaac. And now we got the issue of the land. You see, if you don't have the well, you're not going to survive in the land. So the land is in danger. And how is he going to live as a foreigner and a stranger in this land if he doesn't have a well, if he's not able to give water to his family and to his livestock? How's he ever going to experience the blessing of God? So this well is huge. Now, I don't know about you, but so often I get so confused in life, and I think the story is about me. You know, I was the baby of the family. I thought it was all about me, right? And then I play sports. It's about me, right? Then I go off to school. What? It's about me. College, it's about me. It's about my major. What am I going to do? What are my dreams? What are my plans? What's next? Then I get married. And as we know, in order to have a great marriage, it's about me, right? So you get married, and it's about me. Get into the ministry as a pastor. What? It's about me, right? Start having kids. It's not about the kids any longer. It's about me. You start owning stuff. It's about me. And somehow I've mistaken myself. And I'm saying, Mark, you fool. The story is not about you. God is the director. God is the producer. God is the main character. God has written the script. God knows the conclusion. He allows me to play a part, a minor role in the story. And we see here that Abraham and Abimelech are taking advantage of this God who is gracious and everlasting, who is at work and who's doing mighty things in the life of Abraham. Here's what I see. Let's look at this key word for us, the eternal God, this everlasting God. because it's crucial. It's the frame that's holding the picture together. And in order to do that, I think it would be best if we look at a couple of Psalms. And that everlasting God, hopefully we'll have time at the end and we'll look at that one. That's from Isaiah 40. But before we do that, we need to look at Psalm 90 and Psalm 103. So hold your finger here or go to Psalm 90 and just move over there and stay there for a while, because as a believer, as a follower of Christ, you need to understand, so what? What does it mean that God is the everlasting God, and how does that affect my life, my problems? How does that affect how I approach each and every day? Does it matter? I believe it does matter, just as the Lord Most High matters and the God who sees matters. Psalm 90, this is a prayer of Moses, and I'm trying to learn that in the Psalms, they're prayers, and I need to become better at praying, and so I need to pray through the Psalms, and that's what Moses is doing here. So notice verse 1 of Psalm 90. Look at this. Think about Genesis 21 as we're reading this. Lord, you've been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Okay, Mark, remind myself I'm not the main focus of the story. It's about God, who's everlasting and everlasting and everlasting. Notice verse 4, for 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by. So God keeps on going and going and going, infinity and beyond. He's perpetual. But how do I respond to that? Let your eyes see verse 12. Teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. We need to wake up every day and say, God, since you're the everlasting God and my life is like real short, help me not to waste my short little life. Help me to understand, God, that you're the everlasting. And I look this way, I look that way. There you are. So today I need to ask you, what's the right thing for me to do today? Notice verse 14. Satisfy us. Literally bless us. Pour out your blessing on us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all of our days. I think some of us as Christians, we're depressed. I know there's medical depression and physical depression, but some of us are spiritually depressed because we've never have been wise enough to ask God to bless us in the morning so that we can sing for joy. Notice this everlasting God, though, in verse 17. May the favor of the Lord our God rest upon us. Establish the work of your hands for us. Yes, establish the work of your hands. Literally, this everlasting God wants to work in our story. The story not about us, but what God is doing in our lives, how God is working everything for a specific purpose. If I go back again to this Daniel Gagline who was a bodyguard for Napoleon. And what happens if he just stopped right there and said, well, it's just about me? Well, Napoleon's done for. We got economic problems. I've lost all my spiritual freedom. I'm just going to quit. I don't care about my family. Let them fend for themselves. Instead, he took the Gagelines and he took them to America to give them a hope, to give them a future. And then he built churches because he knew it just wasn't about him, but it was about his children and his grandchildren. It was about his neighbors. It was about his communities. Let's look at Psalm 103. Psalm 103. Everlasting God, eternal God, who is he? Psalm 103, verse 13. This is a prayer of David. This is something we should sing, something we should pray, something we should meditate on. Notice verse 13 of Psalm 103. It says, as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. For he knows how we are formed, and he remembers that we are dust. As for man, his days are like grass. He flourishes like a flower of the field. The wind blows over it, and it is gone, and it is its place remembers it no more. But from everlasting to everlasting, the Lord's love is with those who fear him. And his righteousness with his children's children, those who keep his covenant and remember to obey his precepts. Again, it's not about me. This everlasting God is trying to leave a legacy for my children and their children and their children. And corporately, it's not just about College Avenue Baptist Church. It's not about the gym service. It's not about the sanctuary service. It's not about these buildings. It's about the legacy we are leaving for the next generation. Because we serve a God who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Turn back to Genesis 21. So that is the frame around the picture. Is there any other nuggets in this painting that we need to point out? And I think there are some. You see, the heart of the story is the conflict, the threat, the danger to the land. Now, Beersheba, that's on the southern portion of the promised land. It's sort of the outer mark, but that's where Abraham was, and he was living there as a foreigner and as a stranger, and he was trying to embrace the promises of God, but he was facing all these threats and all these enemies, and he had learned about the Lord Most High. And there needed to be a treaty. There needed to be peace. Now, I don't know about you, but it's helpful for me to know that when the well is stolen, it doesn't take God by surprise. So the well was realistically and figuratively about life. It was about survival. It was essential to have the well. Otherwise, family members die, livestock die. We don't have any blessing. And we need to move on out of the land. And so it's helpful for me to know when my life, my survival, the things I need to feel blessed by God, when they get taken from me, either because of this fallen world or, you want to say, Satan or myself or life or tragedy or whatever happens. Or maybe God's testing. When these wells get taken, God knows about it. And even more important than that, God is present even when these wells are taken. So what am I supposed to do as a Christ follower? I am to pursue peace at all costs. In the New Testament, this is a study you need to do. You need to look up peace and how we're called to be peacekeepers. Matthew 5:8. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be known as sons of God. They will be known as God's children, those who pursue making peace with others. In Mark, in chapter 9, it says, talks about our salt and what happens if we lose our saltiness and stuff. And it says that we need to pursue peace. In order to keep our saltiness and to keep our effectiveness, we need to pursue peace with others. 1 Thessalonians 5:13 says that we are to live in peace. 1 Corinthians says that we are to pursue peace. Hebrews 12:14 is probably the most powerful passage, and it says that we are to live in peace with all people because it produces a special kind of holiness and righteousness. And you know what? It doesn't take New Testament passages to teach us that. Abraham is teaching us this. In order for Abraham to call upon the name of the Lord, which is probably to worship him, to pray to him, to be in a proper relationship with him, he needs to be at peace with his neighbors. It's sort of like a hose. And there's water flowing freely through the hose, and the water is God's grace, God's blessing, God's mercy, God's kindness, and it's flowing through the hose. And all of a sudden, conflict, boom, kink in the hose. And God's grace and mercy and blessing is stuck. And that's where some of us are. That's where some churches are. There's a kink in the hose because people are not pursuing peace. They have resigned to let conflict rule the camp. And Abraham does whatever he can, you know, seven times in here. And that's why they don't know whether Beersheba is for seven or for the oath, because the words are very similar. But seven times, there's an approach. We got to make a covenant. We need to swear to it. We need to be in agreement that we're going to get along. And this passage brings hope to me. If Abraham can make peace with Abimelech, I can make peace with anybody. Can I? even in the most dangerous of situations. What's really interesting is Abimelech, because of what he did to him earlier in Genesis 20, you can go back and read that story, he doesn't trust Abraham. It's nice to know that my enemies, my neighbors who may not know Christ, as long as I'm pursuing peace with them and they don't even trust me, that's a Christian, you know. They don't trust me. They think maybe I'll lie or maybe I'll deceive or whatever. Peace can be restored, and we as believers, we need to be about making peace. That's what the story is about. How can we make peace so that the hose can allow God's grace and mercy to flow freely? What else is this story about? It's about leaving a legacy, my friends. You say, Mark, what's the legacy? Well, look at this tree. This tamarisk tree. Ask yourself the question, who did Abraham plant this tree for? He didn't plant it for himself. I'll tell you that right out of the get-go. And it probably wasn't even for his children. It was probably for his children's children and the next generations. In fact, I saw an article on this tree and just how it was designed, because it took a long time to grow. It says, in the desert there stands a tamarisk tree. Its branches are strong and thick and spread out from the trunk to provide shade for our walk. The trunk must be about 30 inches in diameter, sturdy and tall. A tamarisk tree grows only 1 foot in diameter every 500 years, making this a very old tree. Can you picture the person who planted it? There must have been no instant gratification attitude in him. No one would plant a tamarisk tree if all they wanted to do was enjoy it themselves. That man had a vision. He cared enough about the future to provide shade in the desert for thousands after him. I read that and I look at this. Okay, a stupid tamarisk tree? And yet Abraham had the vision that he wanted to provide shade. He wanted to provide coolness. He wanted to provide refreshment. And he wasn't planting it for himself. I think Abraham was getting the story. I worship an eternal God, an everlasting God, and it's not about me. It's not about little old Abe here, is it? No. It's not about Sarah. It's not about Isaac. It's about God and what God is doing. So how do we leave a legacy? Well, let me give you a couple of suggestions. First of all, this passage is filled with naming. And Pastor Carlton started this series with the importance of names. But Beersheba is an important name. It's a name that goes on and on and on and on. And the people who followed Abraham, his children and the Israelites, they would always remember when they were in Beersheba that this was the place when the land was in danger. The well, there was conflict over the well, and God showed up, the frame of God, the everlasting God. And so what we name our children and certain places and certain experiences we have in life, that is crucial. Our daughter, who was one of them that didn't make it, we named her Mariah. And why did we name her Mariah? Well, you'll find out in Genesis chapter 22, verse 2, they went into the region of Moriah. And when we laid down Moriah, we had already sort of had to lay down our Marcus as well, and we had to lay down an Isaac, and so we named her Moriah Joy. Why? Because it was our time of testing, but also, you know, I won't want to preach Carlton's message for him next Sunday, but the Lord provides. No way did I know when we named our child Mariah that a few years later we would have little Mason. So names are important in leaving a legacy. But you know how else you leave a legacy? You plant a tree. Well, what does it mean to plant a tree? Well, you plant things that are not for yourself, but for future generations. You know, I'm convinced that finances are huge in the story. You don't find one word about money or finances here, but Abraham wanted to get that treaty done so that that well would be their survival. It was like a pot of gold. It was like their money because they needed water. It was the key resource. And so planting the tree meant leaving finances for future generations so you can make a difference. Just think corporately now. What happens if we as a church, we say, I don't give on Sunday because it's not about me. It's not about College Avenue. It's not about paying Pastor Carlton, Pastor Mark, and keeping the lights on and all this stuff. But it's about how can we as a church leave a legacy for future generations? A place that we know will make a difference because the Word of God is being taught. And we're praying and we're trusting in God and we're trying to hear His voice and do what He says. Leaving a legacy is huge. And then there's a spiritual legacy that we've talked about. And what we want to do as a church is partner with parents so that they can bring their children up in the instruction and the discipline of the Lord. And so we need to talk with our children and grandchildren about our relationship with the Lord and how when our wells are taken from us, how we trust in God and rely upon Him. We leave a legacy, my friends. And how do we pursue peace? That one's hard. Because, to be honest, sometimes I look at it and I say, man, we just need to get in peace here in the church because we got a kink in our hose. But that's not the context. The context is, how do we make peace with our neighbors? How do we make peace as College Avenue Baptist Church? How do we make peace with Buddha for You? How do we make peace with College Sub? How do we make peace with San Diego State University? How do we make peace with all the different nationalities that live around College Avenue? How do we make peace? Well, we got to think of ways that we as a church can display kindness and blessing upon our neighbors. And how do we make peace with our neighbors that live by us, who may know we're Christian or may have suspicion that we're Christian? Well, we make peace by displaying kindness. And one of the things that is so important is in this whole story, too, is forgiveness and resolving the conflict. If you got something with your neighbor, your literal neighbor, go and make it right so you can have an opportunity to share with them about a God who is with you and who provides. We need to be better at peacekeeping. We need to fight against conflict so that we can worship God. Notice it says, after this peace treaty and after this legacy had been established with planting the tamarisk tree, notice it says that he called upon the name of the Lord. It followed the desire to leave a legacy. It followed the peacemaking. And so what does it mean to call upon the name of the Lord? Some translations will say pray. Some translations will say worship. Some translations will say he made a sacrifice. And we think about the four key ingredients that we want to be about as a church. We want to worship. We want to invest our time and our talents, our treasures. We want to invest in the neighbors who don't know Christ, the neighbors in our community. We want to pray and we want to love others. In order for that to flow again, so we don't have a kink in our hose, we need to be about pursuing peace. And then we're freed up to pray. And I can tell you right now, some of you, again, take College Avenue out of the picture. In your own life, the reason your prayer life is struggling is because you are at conflict with somebody and you need to be making peace so that you can call upon the name of the Lord. And finally, this everlasting God. I want to close with Isaiah 40. We sang about it in Everlasting God. Let's go to Isaiah 40. And I never should say I'm going to close because you're all turning me out right now. But you're all saying, why didn't he close sooner? You know, but you got to see this because Isaiah 40 is all about God. It's It's all about who God is. And this is my prayer. My prayer for us as individuals, for us as a church. Notice what it says in verse 27 of chapter 40. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? I never say that. Just those people did that. So, but notice, here's my prayer. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength, and they will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint.